Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Margaret Rhodes. It was an accident of birth that's given her an unparalleled view into the lives of the most famous and enigmatic family in Britain. She explains it by saying, "My mother's sister married somebody important, and that's only the start of it. Her aunt was the Queen Mother. The Queen is her first cousin and her friend. In an extraordinary life, she lodged at Buckingham Palace whilst working for MI6, has been held captive after a coup in Bhutan, and adventured her way around half of Africa before becoming the Queen Mother's close companion during her final years. She says of the situation she grew up in, "There was never anything said to make us think we were better than anyone else, just luckier. Now I feel rather like a species of dinosaur left behind by evolution." That's really how you feel, is it?
I do think sometimes one does feel a bit of a dinosaur. And I find it in a way, especially now, because all my brothers and sisters have died. And I am the last dinosaur of my family remaining on this earth. So it's a reasonably accurate sort of description of what I feel like.
You've also said the world you were born into is an almost vanished world of privilege. So do you regret that world passing?
No, the point was that when one was growing up, they didn't seem remotely privileged. My parents were both mad keen gardeners and were perpetually upside down in a flower bed, weeding or doing something, you know. And I was the youngest by a very long way. So that I had a really, in a way, quite a lonely childhood, which suited me fine. I mean, luckily, got me used to being alone now, which I am as a widow. And, of course, I was brought up with a family who were all keen on shooting, fishing, that sort of thing. Certainly during the war, I pursued rabbits and pigeons with great determination in order to have something for the pot.
You pursued an enemy plane once, didn't you?
And I pursued an enemy plane.
You tried to shoot it down, did you? Is that true?
I emptied my entire magazine at a very low-flying German aeroplane that came over, right, literally treetop level. And I thought that, you know, some miracle, I might hit the petrol tank and it would go up in flames.
How old were you?
Needless to say, it flew on totally unscathed.
How old were you when you did that?
About 14.
Right. And as a young girl, you were bridesmaid to the then Princess Elizabeth when she got married. What do you remember of that day?
Well, alas, with old age creeping up on me, I remember less and less. But it was a wonderful and joyful occasion. And in a way, the service in the Abbey, I don't really remember very much about it because one was carried away with the music and everything else, you know. It was just generally a very fun moment.
Is it right that you have a picture of that great day in your downstairs loo?
Yes. And bald answer.
And what does Her Majesty make of that placement?
I don't think she's ever been to my downstairs loo.
Well, that solves that problem then. We're going to, of course, as you know, play your list of eight discs, and it's time to begin with the first disc. Tell me a little bit about the track and why you've chosen it. What are we going to hear now?
Well, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was played incessantly during a really happy time that my husband and I had because we made great friends with a couple who owned a coffee farm in Kenya. And we went out every year where we listened to this and others every evening while drinking white ladies.
What's in a white lady?
Well, it's a mixture of gin and curacao and vodka. No, I can't remember. I've never made one.
Were you all three sheets to the wind then, as you danced?
No, we were very ladylike, quite drinking white ladies.
Who wants to be a millionaire?
I don't.
Have flashy flunkies everywhere?
I don't.
Who wants the bother of a country estate?
A country estate is something I'd hate.
Who wants to wallow in champagne?
I don't.
Who
wants a supersonic plane?
I don't.
Who wants a private landing field too?
That was Who Wants to Be a Millionaire from the soundtrack to High Society. It was performed there by Frank Sinatra and Celeste Holm. It would be indelicate to concentrate on the contents of your downstairs loo for too long. I did mention one thing, which was the Queen and Prince Philip's wedding day at which you were bridesmaid. Also nestled in this loo, I understand, is the little sort of stool that you sat on during the coronation at which you were also present.
Ah, yes.
Tell me about that day at Westminster Abbey. Can you remember what the atmosphere was like on the day of the coronation outside of the Abbey?
I think it was because we had only just recovered from 6-7 years of deprivation and blackouts and rationing, and it was like the sun suddenly coming out behind a lot of very dark clouds. And I think everybody felt also that with a new young queen, a whole new era was opening up. It was somehow exciting.
And now, of course, we're in the year of the Diamond Jubilee. Do you look back over those 60 years and think how remarkable it is, how much Britain has changed?
Well, I think it has changed a lot. But in a way, the thing that's alarming about it is the speed with which those 60 years have gone by.
And how about the Queen herself? How much do you think she has changed in these 60 years?
I think she's a very pragmatic person. And I think she has overseen a gentle change in the monarchy, bringing it a little bit nearer the people. You know, in doing that job, you have to squash the self of you in order to give yourself wholeheartedly to the job. Spontaneity has to leave your life. You know 6 months ahead what you're going to be doing every day. And that demands quite a lot of sacrifice. And she has done that. And I think she's just been a perfectly marvellous queen.
There are people also, as you will be aware, who believe that, you know, this idea of inherited privilege is in itself wrong. I'm interested in how much you think that the constraints that are put on the individual might be a very good reason to not have a monarchy.
Well, all I can say really is that if you don't have a monarch, you have to have a president. I personally can't imagine that people would be wildly overexcited at, say, President Callaghan or President Major, with the same intensity as they view a monarch, and that there's something about hereditariness that, I don't know, but it, in a way it suddenly manages to produce greatness out of those people.
The abdication, of course, is within your living memory. That's, you know, that was a time when somebody couldn't rise to the occasion and didn't put
duty
first.
I was only 13 or something,
yes.
So I didn't make a lot of it. You know, I was too young to have any views about it at that stage. It was just an all-consuming topic of the day, and I think the poor king-to-be and queen-to-be were appalled and horrified at what was happening.
You were, of course, at the wedding last summer of Prince William to Catherine Middleton. Did you feel as if the royal family somehow re-cemented its place in the nation's affection? I mean, it was a day of enormous celebration.
Well, I think it was just a really happy family wedding, quite honestly. It was just, you know, everybody rejoicing that the young couple had come together. A lovely family wedding.
Time for some more music then, Margaret Rhodes. We're going to your second disc of the day. Tell us about this. Why have you chosen this?
Well, this is really part of just remembering how lucky I've been to go to various of the great occasions. And I think this was sung at the coronation of our present queen. So this is just part of the memory of the great events.
Thank you.
The 122nd Psalm, I Was Glad, set to music by Charles Hubert Parry and taken from the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II with the choir of Westminster Abbey. So let's take a little trip back then, Margaret Rhodes. You were born in 1925. Tell me about your home.
Well, I was actually born in London, but my home was in Scotland. It was a sort of moderately big house, and it had what in Scotland are called the policies, which are the sort of estates round about.
The place was Carberry Tower, near Musselburgh, which is just outside Edinburgh. And you used that phrase there, it was wonderful, moderately big. I'm going to tell people just what Carberry Tower consisted of. There were 10 spare bedrooms, a north and south library, an indoor tennis court, a bowling alley, an armoury and a secret tunnel. Is that right?
More or less.
It sounds like a wonderful place to be a child.
Yes, it was. But the armoury and the so-called secret passage, which I think had long been blocked up, was actually too creepy. I used to go past the door in rather a hurry, and I wouldn't go in there by myself. Too frightening.
Is it true you were given a suit of armour as a child?
Yes, my parents got my gender rather wrong. I was never given a doll, for which I was heartily thankful, because I thought they were dreadfully sissy things. But I was given bows and arrows, armour and a sword. So I think they got mildly muddled.
So did the house itself manage that wonderful upper crust thing of combining great grandeur with a real sort of absence of creature comforts? Was the water freezing?
Remembering that my childhood was in the late 20s, which was a very long time ago, there wasn't very much in the way of central heating. And I do remember vividly, because they had a washstand in one's bedroom with a jug of water on it, and the water could freeze in the jug in winter. The last thing our house was grand. I mean, it was gumboots and dirty clothes and mucking about.
Your father had the magnificent name of Sidney Herbert Buller Fullerton, and he was the 16th Lord Elphinstone. He had spent some of his life in the court of Tsar Nicholas II. What had he done there?
That's a slight exaggeration. He merely visited. He led a very adventurous life. I mean, I sometimes feel quite proud of the fact in a funny way, but my father was born in 1867, which was halfway through Queen Victoria's reign. So in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, he was explorer come big game hunter. He went to marvellous places which he'd probably never seen a European before.
And his motto was, have gun, will travel.
Well, theoretically, yes.
Yes, yes.
Because he didn't marry till he was nearly just on 40. By the time I was conscious of him, he was quite an old man.
Did he bring back any of his trophies?
Well, there were a few odd heads stuck about the house, yes, including a lovely, lovely, proper grizzly bear who lived in the hall. And he was a very formidable fellow.
Your father gave you what sounds to me to be some pretty sound advice, which, as he said, the only things to be regretted in life are the yes. things you don't do.
Well, I thought it was rather a splendid thing to tell your child. I love adventure. I love the feeling it's just possible that I'm treading on a stone that nobody's ever actually trodden on before.
Right, let's have some music then, Margaret Rhodes. We're on your third disc of the day. Tell me what we're going to hear now.
There were two lovely books in my childhood called The Songs of the North, and the particular one called Lizzie Lindsay used to be sung by my eldest brother, the one who was going to end up in Colditz as a prisoner of war. And he used to sing this a great deal, so it brings back memories.
All ye gang to the Hielands, Lizzie Lindsay. All ye gang to the Hielands o' me. All ye gang to the Hielands, Lizzie Lindsay. My bride and my darling to be.
That was Belle Stewart and the traditional Scottish air Lizzie Lindsay. You mentioned going into that, Margaret Rhodes, your brother John. He was taken prisoner for 5 years during
yes.
the war. He spent part of that time in Colditz. Do you remember him coming home?
Oh, I do. You know, it was 5 whole years, and you think what that does to a young man. It's sort of such a huge chunk of life gone. He was a member of a little group called the Prominente, who the Germans used as hostages, really, you know. Towards the end, it became apparent that German high command had ordered them to all be shot. And my brother was actually the senior officers of the party, and he managed to talk the German general into agreeing that if he signed their death warrant, he would be signing his own death warrant, because the Germans could see that the war was being lost. And he managed to convince him of this, and thus got them out eventually.
How changed was he? How different was he than the brother
had
gone off to war?
I think he never talked about life as a prisoner. It was sort of sad, really, because he never got married. So he had a lonely life, in a way. But he was actually such fun himself, you know.
You say that your parents were always sort of upside down in the garden, digging something up or planting something or deadheading something. I mean, how much time did you spend with your parents as a little girl?
Well, as a very small child, remarkably little, one was brought down in a nice little dress at tea time. I mean, I loved them both dearly, and they loved each other frantically, which was sweet, you know. I mean, I can actually remember going round our little pond lake thing that we had. I can remember walking around, say to myself that I was going to make up my mind to have as good and happy a marriage as my parents had had, which I did.
And what about being a parent then? Because you have four children yourself, now, of course, all grown up. But did you think, well, actually, it might be a better idea to spend a bit more time with my children than my mother and father are spending with me? Of
necessity, in a way, because, you know, circumstances have changed to the next generation. I have to slightly shamefacedly admit that I had a nanny, a nursery maid, and we had a married couple. He did the garden and she did the cooking. But that didn't last very long. And, you know, the nannies disappeared in the end.
Let's have some music, Margaret Rhodes. It's time for your fourth choice of the day. What are we going to hear?
We're going to have Night and Day with good old Fred Astaire.
Tell me why you've chosen this.
Well, because it's sort of the epitome of the having achieved grown-upness. It was just what was being played, and it was, you know, it was just a nice tune of the moment, which reminds me of that moment.
Like the beat, beat, beat of the tom-tom when the jungle shadows fall. Like the tick, tick, tock of the stately clock as it stands against the wall. Like the drip, drip, drip of the raindrops when the summer shower is through. So a voice within me keeps repeating, you, 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 night and day, you are the one.
That was Fred Astaire and Night and Day. You used to spend summer holidays at Balmoral with the young princesses, Elizabeth and Margaret. What are your memories of those times?
Oh, well, it started from when I was really very small, and they were living at Duke and Duchess of York at Burke Hall, which was a smaller house at Balmoral. And it was a great, wonderful holiday of the year, you know. And it's a blissful house. It's heaven. Not grand. It's a small little 18th-century house, built on a hill where the garden goes steeply down to a burn at the bottom. We just had such fun there until 1935-6, when all the drama started. You know, it was just playing. We rode Shetland ponies. We went on picnics. They had a little island at the bottom in the burn. We used to go down and have picnic teas there. Well, I regret to say that we used to have a competition to see how many slices of brown bread and golden syrup could be eaten in one go, which I won, with 12 slices of bread and golden syrup.
Were you sick? That sounds disgusting.
No, absolutely. Probably would have eaten another lot if I could.
I find it hard to imagine how much formality and how much etiquette is still expected if you are in very close daily proximity and are a friend of the family. Are there certain do's and don'ts?
Well, I think from my point of view, merely, I do not enter the political talk.
Yes.
I keep clear of that. I mean, I curtsy to the Queen. It was much more formal in the King and Queen's day. I'm just thinking of Balmoral for the moment. All the guests were ready in the drawing room by the time the King and Queen came in, always in long evening dresses. You were more or less made to stand in a line and look pretty, and then they came in and you curtsied. But, I mean, now it's much more informal, which is much nicer.
A lot of your intimate personal memories are tied up with the lives of the royal family. Was it difficult to sort of approach the royal family and say, this is a book I'd like to write?
No. I told her ages before that I was thinking of writing. And then I remember asking her if I could tell the story of when we hid under the tablecloth.
Just tell me a little bit of the detail of that, hiding under the tablecloth.
We were having tea on a terrace at Windsor Castle with my friend Elizabeth Longman and the King and Queen, the two princesses, in the war. And suddenly they heard American voices, loud American voices, coming round the corner below. And the King said, "Oh, my God, I forgot, it's General Eisenhower bringing a whole party of people round." And the King and Queen just looked at each other. They never said a word. And they got up and they both got under the tablecloth. And we all followed suit rather more slowly, giggling under the tablecloth until the Americans had gone. But I know that the Queen had confessed to General Eisenhower that this had happened. So she said it was quite all right for me to do it.
Let's have some more music, Margaret Rhodes. We're on your fifth choice of the day.
Oh, Tom Lehrer.
Yes.
When my husband had a heart attack and was in hospital, Princess Margaret sent him the Vatican rag. That's how we first got to know about it.
First you get down on your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Whatever steps you want, if you have cleared them with the pontiff, everybody say his own, Kyrie eleison, doing the Vatican rag.
Tom Lehrer and the Vatican rag, and it still makes you laugh, Margaret Rhodes. You were enjoying that thoroughly.
Yes, it's really, really good fun, that one.
Let's talk about your war years then. I'm not quite sure where to begin. I said in the introduction that you lodged at Buckingham Palace and you worked for MI6.
Yes.
It could hardly sound more extraordinary.
I suppose it does. You know, to this day and age, I think I really wanted to join the Wrens. And I rather fancied the thought of being one of those ladies who push ships about on a huge screen, you know. Anyway, for whatever reason it was, I didn't become a Wren, and I became a secretary in MI6.
How were you recruited to MI6?
I honestly, I promise you, I can't remember. I mean, it just sort of happened. The head of the organisation was just known by the letter C, and he wrote in green ink, and he was God. I mean, he promised you, he was really God. It was very interesting. I'm actually involved getting reports of all the agents coming to my desk. And before they happened, one knew all about where the V1s were being made and heavy water factories in Norway and all that kind of thing, you know.
In terms of the information that you had access to then during the war, I mean, you would read the information coming in, collate it, and then presumably pass it on to somebody else. But,
yes.
You must have understood a pretty good deal of it, did you?
Yes, well, one couldn't help but understand it. But I've always thought the funny thing about human beings is how quickly and easily they can adapt to a whole lot of different circumstances. I mean, it didn't seem odd, for instance, that I might go and spend a weekend with my family and old friends out of London and come back and then walk through streets with flaming buildings and glass shattered and bombs dropping. You know, it just happened and you did it.
And you said, I mean, you had a governess, but you were never formally educated. Your brothers went to Eton and then on to Oxford.
Yeah.
I wonder if, in a way, the war intervening meant that actually you had a much more liberated life.
Oh, yes, I think. Oh, absolutely. I think otherwise, at an 18-year-old, I'd have been, I was probably sitting in a carpet still, you know.
So what was it like living at Buckingham Palace? What are the? You had your own apartment, did you, or you?
Well, in the end, it was really nice because my brother, the other brother, Andrew, came back to London and said we both lodged at Buckingham Palace and we were given a housemaid's pantry where we could cook. So we had tiny little place with a tiny little table and we didn't have a fridge or anything exotic. So I put the milk bottle out on the windowsill and got a rocket out of all proportion to my hideous act by the master of the household, who said that I was defacing the front of Buckingham Palace, putting milk bottles on the windowsill, not at all the London thing. And then one glorious moment, we actually had the King and Queen to dinner in their own housemaid's pantry.
Can you remember what you cooked?
No, but I do remember we used to be able to buy whole pigeons for 2 and 6, half a crown. Maybe we gave them pigeon. I honestly can't remember any of that. But it was all interesting and fun during that period of life.
Let's have some music then, yes. Margaret Rhodes. We're going on to your sixth choice. Tell me about this.
Oh, right. Well, my husband's brother His son is Teddy Tahu Rhodes, brought up entirely in New Zealand. And he actually, Gotham has a wonderful voice. And he's singing something which I don't know what it means. Anyway, it's from The Marriage of Figaro.
Non piantrai farfallone amoroso, notte e giorno d'intorno girando, delle belle trovando riposo, narcisetto aloncino d'amor. Delle belle trovando riposo, narcisetto aloncino d'amor. Non più avrai questi bei pennacchini, quel cappello leggero e galante, quella chioma, quell'aria brillante, quel vermiglio non è scoccolor, quel vermiglio non è scoccolor. Non più avrai quei pennacchini, quel cappello, quella chioma, quell'aria brillante.
Teddy Tahu Rhodes with the Tasmanian Symphony Orchestra and Non Più Andrai from Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. Now, here's a thing, Margaret Rhodes, for someone whose life has been that of privilege and doing things properly, when you fell in love, it was with a penniless married man. What happened to your upper-class pragmatism
really
there?
What my parents thought was the most brilliant idea that had ever been. But anyway, that was no good because I'd fallen in love, and by the time I'd met him, he was already well separated from his first wife.
Dennis's first marriage was annulled. Did that make it easier for the King and Queen to attend your
yes,
wedding?
Yes, because we could be married in church.
I see. So that was important.
It was very important.
So the King and Queen attended your wedding.
Yes.
Princess Elizabeth couldn't come because she was pregnant with,
that's
at that
right,
point, Princess
yes.
Anne.
Yeah.
Princess Margaret was one of your bridesmaids.
Yes.
I mean, it all sounds quite grand. Did you bring London to a standstill?
Well, there were, obviously, because the King and Queen were coming. I mean, you know, so there were quite big crowds. All Dennis kept on saying, apparently the bridegroom pays for the bells to be rung in churches. And he was counting, literally, all the bells, thinking he wouldn't be able to pay for them all.
You set up home in Devon then, and your husband wrote a little, and he would go on sort of scientific explorations and tours and things. In 1964, you went on a trip to Bhutan.
Yes.
And you ended up hitching up with Shirley MacLaine, which seems
that
a little unlikely.
That was very surprising, wasn't it?
Yes, that was.
Years back, Dennis had been friends with a lady from Sikkim who, you know, you must come to Sikkim, you know, hotly followed by a wonderful invitation on hand-rolled rice paper covered in gold for her brother's wedding. Her brother was the son of what was then called the Maharaja. So we begin with, we laughed it off, and then we thought, would one ever be asked to a Buddhist wedding in the heart of the Himalayas? The whole thing was out of this world, really, you know. We were guests of the brother, and Shirley MacLaine was the guest of somebody else. But we did eventually land up together. She was awfully nice. I mean, rather surprisingly nice, because I know I always expect famous actresses to be rather sort of snooty, you know.
They sometimes are.
Yes.
And so there was a coup, and you were held
captive.
And
there was a coup, and so we were very much persona non grata, and had really quite a difficult and dramatic time trying to get out of the country, because we kept on hearing of people being tortured, put in prison, and, you know. So we made our way back to the frontier. We suddenly heard tramp, 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 and the brigade of Bhutanese soldiers had surrounded the guest house we were in and sat there with their rifles pointing inwards at us all. One of the difficulties was that they let us go, but they wanted to detain the local people who were looking after us, and they were going to be really cruel to them, and we wouldn't stand for that. And then, I mean, in the end, after a lot of negotiations, they agreed to let us go and to take these two with us. But it was quite dramatic while it was all happening.
Yes, it sounds very dramatic. Are you in possession of a stiff upper lip? Are you one of these people who sort of just gets on with it?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's part of enjoying adventure, isn't it?
Let's have some music then,
right.
Margaret Rhodes.
What have we got to?
We're on your
sevens.
We've
got the Lord's Our Shepherd, my
yes.
Shepherd.
Tell me why you've chosen this.
Well, it's very much, again, Scottish childhood. It's just part of me, almost.
Lord, my shepherd, Lord, he makes me
The 23rd Psalm, The Lord's My Shepherd, performed there by the Norwich Cathedral Choir. I want to ask you a little bit more about your husband, Dennis. You've written that he was one of those people who felt himself that he wouldn't be very long-lived. Is that
true? Well, he did. He said to me he'd never make old bones. What made him think that? I honestly don't know. Sadly, he was right.
So some years, Margaret Rhodes, after your husband, Dennis, died, you became one of the official companions to the Queen Mother. She was, of course...
I was technically just a lady-in-waiting.
A lady-in-waiting.
Well, actually, I wasn't even technically a lady-in-waiting, because it divided very sharply. There are two ladies who have to be actually lady something or other.
I see.
Who go to the very grander things with Queen Elizabeth. Common old things like me were called women of the bedchamber.
Oh, dear.
You know, it was going with her when she was doing engagements and things and dealing with the letters.
You've been very good, I notice, in interviews, in a fairly discreet but firm way at putting some of the rumours about the late Queen Mother to rest, saying, you know, people say, oh, she'd hollow legs and she was always at the booze.
Yes,
and all
she was, yes, always had a thing about her drinking.
Yes, and you've said...
Absolute rubbish.
Yes. What would she typically imbibe then?
Well, she drank... At lunchtime, she'd have du bonnet. At dinner, in the evening, she'd have a martini. Really, that was it. I mean, she didn't drink wine at all. And she would occasionally have a little drip of champagne.
And so, I mean, obviously you had official duties. As you were saying, you dealt a lot with correspondence.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of work generated around about the life she lived. But did you have fun together? Did you?
Oh, yes,
together?
Because everything one did with her was fun. I mean, I can remember doing the very dullest things that you could imagine. And somehow it was fun. She had this miraculous way of somehow turning everything into fun. And I don't know how she did it. She was just heaven to work for.
You were with her when she died, and you've written that it was a very calm and it was a very peaceful time. What can you tell me about it?
Well, I don't really honestly want to talk about that very much, but it because it was a very private time. She didn't talk or say anything. And I got the clergyman to come and say prayers and things, and it was just very peaceful.
You have 7 grandchildren, 3 great-grandchildren, and I understand that great-granny has taught her grandchildren to, or one of them at least, to shoot and skin a rabbit. Is that right?
Oh, well, yes, I probably have, because I certainly know how to do it. It's quite useful, a bit of knowledge to
well,
partake of.
You can probably see where I'm going with this, because, as you know, we're casting your way to the desert island,
oh,
and
yes,
you're going to have to survive.
Oh, yes, of course.
So it won't be a problem.
No, I think boredom will be my problem.
But you'll be a survivor apart from the loneliness?
Yes, I think I'd be quite a survivor.
Let's have your final piece of music then, Margaret Rhodes.
Oh,
what
right,
are we going to hear?
Yes, we've got a nice one.
Yes, tell me about this.
Well, because my husband, we all adored Bring Me Sunshine with Walkman Wise. So this is just memory of all the happy times we had with children watching all those programmes.
Bring me sunshine in your smile, bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years.
Bring Me Sunshine, performed, of course, by Eric Morecambe and Ernie Wise. So, Margaret Rhodes, here we are with the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare and another book, your book. What are you going to take?
Well, after a lot of thought, I am going to take the big Reader's Digest book of British gardens, and I shall spend happy hours devising well-watered green gardens.
It's yours. And, of course, you're allowed a luxury, too. What will your luxury be?
Well, I wanted to take my dog. Are you going to allow that?
No.
No. How unkind of you. Well, I will have to take... I'll take my favourite jersey in case cold nights are available on the desert island.
Right. Do you have a single favourite jersey? What colour is it?
Blue.
Scottish cashmere,
yes,
is it?
Scottish.
Yes, lovely. Right, that's yours. And if you had to just pick one of these 8 discs to save from the waves, which one would you save?
I think I do Tom Lehrer.
Right.
I want to be able to keep laughing.
It's yours. Margaret Rhodes, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Oh, thank you so much for being so kind to me.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.